Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at WOW, the World of Wildlife. That's the acronym for World of Wildlife, with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors and certainly to answer your wildlife questions. And I hope you'll join the conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry, and hello to all the listeners today. It's great to be back, and it's great to see, I hate to see time pass, but it's great to see the end of 2020 in sight.
Well, that's for sure. I tell you what, I'm already getting some calls and questions about bird feeding, and lots of people feed birds year-round, but some just do it in the wintertime. Does it make a difference when it comes to attracting birds to your feeder?
Probably not. I think that's more a matter of human preference and the notion that's been conveyed over the years that, hey, the birds can take care of themselves in the summertime. There's plenty of food out there. And therefore, winter's the time of shortage of food and hardship, cold and so forth, and stress. So that's the best time. And that remains true. However, I think the factor that sometimes goes overlooked is that a lot of people feed birds, despite what they may say, for the value that the birds convey to them, seeing them, enjoying them, hearing them, and so on. And therefore, those same values hold throughout the year. So we feed. We, my wife and I here at the house, feed year-round now and actually enjoy the summer feeding when the windows are open and you can hear more and there are more species around because the breeding birds are here. And it's kind of neat to see some regular summer visitors, like a couple pairs of rose-breasted grosbeaks that we seem to get every summer and a few others. And they bring their young in later on in the breeding season. And that all kind of adds to the whole picture. But this year was especially, I should say exciting, but particularly well used by the public because people were so much confined to home and bird feeding just provided a release, something you could do at home and get into. So I think the regular feeders really enjoyed that, and some new people came on board as well.
Yeah. You know what? Carl in Eagle River has a question having to do with water for birds. Let's go there. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, my question is about giving water to birds. Is there anything we can add to the water to maybe help them out a little bit in the severe winter up here in Eagle River?
Some vitamins or whatever, huh?
I've never seen any reference to that kind of additive. I think the real issue is simply the availability of water. And we've noticed our birds around the house here have been very diligent in using the bird bath. Of course, this time of year, the bird bath gets very difficult to keep open. It freezes up every night. So I think we're probably going to move to a heated bird bath. There are a number of different designs available where there's a little heating unit built into the basin, and then that could be mounted on a deck railing or on its own freestanding base. And I suspect the birds will use it heavily. Right now, our backyard pond, or a little water garden feature, which has frozen over, is maintained in terms of gas exchange by a small floating heating unit, which keeps a disc open in the ice, maybe the size of a dinner plate. And some of the birds and the squirrels have already figured out that the water's hard. They can walk across the ice and go to this little circular opening in the pond and use that as a source of water. So they're pretty creative about that. But usually there's enough meltwater along the eaves or a south-facing roof or something like that that they can find water. But it's certainly an attractive thing for them that can enhance your bird feeding station.
Yeah, that makes sense. Carl, thanks for that question. Appreciate it very much. Keith in Wanakee emailed that in October he had a large flock of pine siskins that stayed around all month. He hasn't seen many before this year, Would you explain more about them and what kind of food is best when they migrate and to where? Where are the winter residents? Are they only summer residents, Pine Siskins?
Well, they're summer residents in their northern part of their range. They're a northern bird, but they do move down here for the winter and further south, along with red poles and grosbeaks and evening grosbeaks and juncos and assorted other birds we don't see much during the summer here, say in the Madison area, but that move in potentially in large numbers in the winter. But that really depends on the severity of the winter. Tough going up north tends to move more birds further south. And if it's an open winter down here, in other words, relatively little snow, so there are some food sources available other than feeders, you may or may not see large numbers of these birds at feeding stations. Plus, since they travel in flocks, it may be a here today, gone tomorrow phenomenon. And some of these things, like the evening grosbeaks, for example, wander around, and you see them for a few days, they're gone. You may see them again, you may not.
Scott, well, you know, this whole business about food, what is there a best food for winter for the birds, for your winter bird feeding?
Well, you can buy all sorts of mixes and blends and so forth, but I feed straight black oil sunflower. Black oil sunflower has almost completely overtaken the old gray-striped sunflower, the big sunflower seeds that were the only game in town several decades ago. But black oil is, they're smaller, they have a lot of energy in them, and they're utilized by virtually all species right down the line, from the smallest finches, the goldfinches and house finches and so forth, on up to jays and even some of the woodpeckers, cardinals, and so on. Now, having said that, if you want to make life a little easier for the birds, you can feed hulled sunflower pieces. You can feed seeds that are particularly attractive to certain species, like cardinals, like safflower. But some of the options, including thistle, which is Niger thistle, which is it's not a thistle per se, but it's attractive to the finches. These things do the job, but they can be a little more pricey in terms of buying feed materials. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to put a little out at a time and see how they do. But overall, sunflower seed does the trick. The bargain, well, I shouldn't say bargain, but the mixed seeds that include a lot of milo and millet and things like that will be utilized. But if you put those mixes in your feeder, you'll find that some of them, like maybe red millet or whatnot, kind of remain at the end and are not as desirable as other things. So,
yeah,
I don't think you can go wrong with sunflower.
No, I don't think so either. Russ in Stoughton has something relating to feed. Let's go there. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, good morning. I have two things. I had, this goes back 3-4 years ago, I had robins in the spring build a large nest on top of my back porch light. And I even blocked out my rear door so I wouldn't go out to disturb them. And eventually the eggs came and the babies came. And at the same time, one of my feeders, the suet feeder, ran out of suet. The woodpeckers ate it. I had nothing to stuff in there. So I stuffed it full of chunks of white bread. And the next thing you know, the robins learned how to land, believe it or not, on the suet feeder, and they would pick out about every two minutes, they would pick out a chunk of white bread and bring it back to their nest to feed the babies. I thought that was amazing, being that they're ground feeders. And the other thing is, I noticed for years that black-capped chickadees, which in my feeders I have thistle and I have saffron, and they will land, pick out one seed, fly away on a nearby bush, chap it out, I guess, with their feet holding it, eat it, and then they fly back and just get one more. Kind of a waste of energy, I think, and time.
Russ, thanks for calling. Comment, Scott.
Well, a couple things. I I watch the same thing with our chickadees here and think, boy, such a tiny little bird and a single seed. And instead of usually staying in the feeder like some birds do, they will grab a seed, fly to a tree, peck it open, and come back. And it does seem like wasted energy, but it seems to work for them. And they get along just fine. As far as the bread's concerned, I'm kind of surprised the robins took that. But, hey, seeing is believing. Generally speaking, try and recommend against, or try and not recommend, using, you know, bread, stale bakery products, old cereal, things like that, because while some birds will eat it, it tends to be favored by some of what we call or think of as more or less desirable birds. English sparrows, starlings, some of the blackbirds in the summer, grackles, things like that, that will readily eat those household commodities, but aren't necessarily particularly desirable at the feeder. But, hey, if it worked for that family of robins, then so be it.
Yeah, thank you, Russ. Appreciate it. Pat in Hudson has another bird-related question, I believe. Pat, hi.
Hi. Actually, I was going to comment on my battle with the squirrels in the suet, and I finally had to wave the white flag. And I did find a suet recipe online that uses ground up really nice dried hot peppers. It's like ground up a bunch, and then I made the suet, but I did not have something called chick starter. So I took and I soaked some premium dog food until it was soft, and I used that in the suet recipe. And I have a major grouping of, I have pileated woodpeckers, downies, hairies, the red belly, and then the chickadees and the nuthatches. It's really, really popular. And the squirrels are leaving it alone. So I'm wondering if there's any problem with using a premium dog food that's softened in the suet. Is it going to hurt the birds?
I don't see why. I think the advantage that you've discovered with dog food is that there are a variety of additives and commodities mixed into those dry kibble. And as you crush it up, it becomes a lot more of a diverse source of nutrients than, say, just something like cornmeal, which is a single, basically a single ingredient. So maybe you've stumbled onto something, Pat. I can see it now. Pat suet cakes. Buy at all of our local stores. But that's an interesting idea. Battles with the squirrels are almost universal. Some people do throw up the white flag. But, again, thinking about our own feeding station here, we put up a squirrel feeder off to the side in a tree. It looks like some of them are called squirrely gyms. There are a lot of names for them, but basically it's a couple of screw eyes that you screw a cob of corn on, and then the thing is attached with a metal cable to an overhanging limb, and it's got kind of a spring or bungee cord situation so that you suspend the corn a couple of feet off the ground, and the squirrels learn to jump up to it and latch on to get a kernel or two, and they bounce around and swing and sway, and it's kind of entertaining to watch them. And to a certain degree, it keeps them off some of the feeders, but not completely. We've also had very good luck lately. My wife in particular is enamored of feeding whole shelled peanuts, a handful every morning out the patio door, onto the deck, and a family of four or five blue jays. I think they've got little binoculars, and they sit in the treetops just waiting for the door to open, because usually you can barely get back in and latch the door before the blue jays start parading in. And the interesting thing is the way they pick around in the peanuts and pick one up, kind of give it a shake, or I think they're actually evaluating its weight for making sure that there's actually a nut in it. But they'll spit one out, grab another one, spit that out, oh, that's the one I like, and away they go to either stash it or eat it. So that's been entertaining, too, and that also keeps the squirrels around. So,
thank you, Pat. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. We're taking a break from pitching on this show today, but we're still in our year-end member drive right now, and we are part of your day. We're your source for connection to your community, to the state, to the whole world for that matter, and certainly we appreciate your gift. So if you haven't contributed during our drive, I hope you'll do it right now. Go to WPR.org That's WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552 and make a contribution in support of Scott Craven and the program here from 11 to 1230. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Question, we've been talking about bird feeding, but we can certainly take other questions as well. I know we want to talk about the deer season, and there are some DNR meetings coming up, too, that we want to remind you about. But join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Larry in Racine has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how you doing? I just want to say something that I think, Larry, you are a treasure to Wisconsin and radio.
Thank you.
Okay. My question is, I've been in Wisconsin almost my whole life. I've never seen a badger. I was on my patio middle of August, and I noticed this animal, which you can tell it's a badger right away, but he was kind of sleeping under a tree. And he stayed there for about 5 or 6 hours. And I didn't know if he was alive or dead. So I was going to go over there and poke him with a stick. But I saw him breathing, and my common sense came back and said, don't. But I was wondering if that is normal behavior. It was just out in the grass under a tree, and it's the first time I had ever seen something like that. Hmm. Is that normal?
Well, Larry, seeing a badger is a rare treat in Wisconsin under any circumstances, especially having one taking a nap in your backyard. That's really unusual. But like you, up until that point, I've not seen a live badger in Wisconsin. I've seen animals killed on the road, or so they're on the side of the road or whatnot. And when I was working regularly at the university, people would bring one in maybe on an annual basis that they found dead, and it would end up in a museum collection. So it's a rare sighting to see a badger in any event. Why one? They're generally a pretty secretive animal, and of course they burrow. So during broad daylight, I'd expect them to be close to or in their burrow, but hey, who knows? Nice afternoon, warm sunny spot, or a little shade on a hot sunny day, and the animal simply takes a break. I can't say that that's something we hear about commonly, if at all.
No.
But you saw it, so I'm glad your common sense came back to you, Larry, because poking a badger with a stick would not have been a good idea. For a couple of reasons, and the other one that comes to mind to me is that since that does seem like a little bit of an odd thing for a badger to be doing for that length of time, there's always the possibility that the animal was sick in some way, or perhaps had been nicked by a car and was, you know, debilitated in some way. I can't say, we'll never know now, but I guess we could add a new expression, you know, let sleeping badgers lie. along with dogs, and you had a chance to see it, so that's the important thing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, Larry. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I have one chance to see a live badger in the wild, and that's many years ago when I was pheasant hunting with some friends, and we were back in a marsh and happened to see, kind of sort of kicked one up, I think, in a way. But it's a rare sight for sure, and you were lucky to be able to see it, Larry. I hope you took some pictures. I hope you got some shots of it. Thank you for calling. Well, Kathy in Fifield, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Rare sight for sure, and you were lucky to be able to see it, Larry.
Kathy, are you there?
I hope you got some shots of it. Thank you for calling.
I think she may be not there. Let's take... maybe take another call. Rick in New Glarus, we'll go to you. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Scott. So, Scott, I want to remind that, as you did, that how important water is to these birds, especially when the water's frozen in the mornings. They're all out looking for water as they eat the seeds that we're giving them. And so What we came up with is Blaine's sells a really nice stainless steel 5-quart heated pet bowl that we put some rocks in, and they are all over it all morning and until that water thaws out. And additionally, I want to just confirm, if you want a way to spend your money, we're feeding about 5 pounds of those in-the-shell peanuts to Jays, and they are ravenous for those peanuts. If you want Jays, in-the-shell unsalted peanuts is absolutely the trick. So.
There you go, Rick. Thank you for calling. Comment, Scott?
Well, the peanuts do work great, and we solve the multiple cost factor by rationing them a bit. So they get a handful each morning, and when they're gone, they're gone. And they may come and sit on the railing and squawk and look at us for a while, but they know that there'll be more out the next morning. And I think they're cashing a fair number of them anyway, so I think rationing may be the strategy. And any creative way to add water, as we talked about a little earlier, is a good thing, and the birds will respond to that nicely. So,
yeah, thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Mike in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I have a badger story for you. About 10 years ago on Mother's Day, we were bringing my wife's mother home for dinner, and we're going down the road. It was middle of the day, and we could see a big light sand colored mound and a badger out on the sand. So I stopped the car, and two more badgers came out. There were three badgers at the hole, and the biggest one, which I assume was a male, charged the car. So I'm just parked on the road, and the badger came out, and it's snarling at us, and it ran around in circles for a minute, and then it went back to the hole, and they all disappeared. And about a week later, we saw them a second time. So that was a real treat, and it was the only time we ever saw badgers.
Hmm.
That is a neat story. And people should be advised, going back to, I should have poked it with a stick a few minutes ago. They're a pretty good-sized animal. They're very powerful. They're a large member of the weasel family. They're not known for a pleasant disposition, and they've got huge claws, which they use primarily for digging. But they're really not an animal. They're fun to see, but not an animal to be messed around with unless you know what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. Good points. Mike, thanks a lot. That's an interesting story for sure. Kathy in Fifield, on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, thank you. A couple of unusual sightings. We've had a brown thrasher way up here in northern Wisconsin now for a little bit over a week. This morning it was 10 degrees, and it was on the ground under our feeders, jabbing at the ground with its beak. So that was unusual. And then my first sighting of a Lapland longspur. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of in the weedy area alongside the road. So anyway, you know, just something to share.
Well, thank you, Kathy. And Scott, in Madison, we had a pretty rare bird sighting in the Madison area, a black-throated gray warbler.
Yes, the black-throated gray warbler, which is kind of a western mountain species, showed up at Turville Point on Lake Monona. Apparently, it's been there for a month or so, and lots of people, as is the case with rare bird sightings, have been heading on over there to try and get a look at it. At first glance, it looks sort of chickadee-like, not a big bird, but there have been some pictures of it in the local papers, and it's attracted a lot of publicity, as do unusual bird sightings. There are a few other records in the past of this species around the state, but anything that's unusual like this gets people's attention, and anything that gets people outside with something to do while we're still shuttered down by COVID, I think has attracted more attention than perhaps in a normal year.
Yeah, so, and Kathy's
As far as the sightings at Fifield, the brown thrasher is pretty unusual. The Lapland longspurs are usually seen along roadsides, so as you're driving along on rural roads, there'll be flocks of birds on the roadside. Could be longspurs, could be horned larks, could be snow buntings. That's a great way to see any of those three species that tend to show up in open country in the winter.
Yeah, Kathy, thanks again. Appreciate it. Well, Gary in Ween, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. Love the show always. I was fortunate enough to see a badger up in the Spread Eagle Barrens area up along the Menominee River.
Yeah.
I was hiking up there. Saw it for like about 10 seconds, and it scurried off, but it was pretty cool. But I'm calling with a red squirrel story. We've had, over the years, fox squirrels and red squirrels and gray squirrels coming to our feeder, and they've usually outsmarted me. But we were looking at this red squirrel, and I was using my binoculars and my mammal book for North America to make sure it was a red squirrel and not a fox. And I put out a live trap, and it didn't work. And my wife and I were watching out the window trying to decide it was on the feeder. It dropped to the ground and was feeding on sunflower seeds on the ground. And in this spirea bush, which was about 3 feet away, a cat came out and started chasing it. And the squirrel ran into a tarp by a wood pile, and there was no exit. And about 5 seconds later, the cat came out with the squirrel, and we looked at each other at what we'd just seen, and we were sort of shocked. So I put a fence up around the spirea so the cat can't hide in there to get birds, and a red squirrel problem is solved.
Well, there are several aspects of that, Gary. On the one hand, an act of predation on a wild animal, on another wild animal, is just the way it is. A lot of animals eat other animals. So seeing a Cooper's hawk, for example, come in and grab a cardinal off someone's feeder is both a stressful event to see, but also a very natural thing. Cats, especially feral cats, and we've talked about this for years on the program, are a problem for lots of different types of wildlife, particularly birds, but also small mammals. And if you figured out a way to prevent that from happening again, despite the fact that it solved your immediate squirrel problem, anything that can be done to provide some safe haven for birds as they're coming and going from feeders is a good idea. And that includes hazards posed by large windows or by predators that may frequent the area as well. So
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Gary. Terry emailed that about 2 weeks ago he heard several owls hooting for prolonged periods of time while he was out walking in the neighborhood at night. Wondered why they hoot so much this time of the year. It's not mating season, is it? Is it to establish territory?
Well, it has some things to do with territory and some things to do with family life and so forth. I mean, the common species to be hooting now are barred owls. And I've heard barred owls hooting throughout the year. And if you learn how to imitate the call, which isn't particularly difficult, you can go out around, or if you happen to live on the edge of town or near a woods or whatnot, do a little hooting, you'll often get them to answer you. So they're talking with each other from time to time throughout the year. And we're not that far away now that we're in December, that the horned owls will be setting up their breeding territories before too long in early winter, such that they'll be nesting in February. And so there's a lot going on in the world of owls, and it's not that unusual to hear some hooting just about any time of the year.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about feeding the birds. Earlier this year on a program, we heard about cutting back because there was an abundance of food and it would help us with our budget, not to have to buy so much feed. But so I'm wondering, now that it's cold, if I should start again now to fill up our feeders. But there's a caveat, because we're snowbirds and we're going to leave in about a month for 3 months, and nobody will be here to refill the feeders. Should I even begin feeding them again at this time?
You know, Barbara, I guess it depends a little bit on your immediate surroundings. If you're out in a rural area where there are no other homes nearby, then maybe at this point it's been fairly open so far as lack of snow. If you're getting ready to head for the south to avoid the winter you could put out, throw out a few seeds to keep them interested, but not dependent, and then go to Florida or wherever you're going with a clean conscience. A lot of people ask about that question, but in most settings, bird feeding is such a popular activity that any group of birds in a neighborhood or a rural subdivision or whatever have a number of feeder options to go to. And they're rarely dependent enough on one feeding station that the absence of food is going to be a lethal or dangerous problem. So I don't think you need to worry about that a whole lot. And as far as trying to cut back a little bit to save on the budget, I just urge you to keep your eye out for seed sales and buy in bulk. I watch the sales regularly just to see what's going on. And right now, especially with the holidays coming out, you can get this black oil sunflower seed we've been talking about in 10 or 15 or 20-pound bags, and they're going to be maybe $10, $12, $14. But if you watch for the sales, the 50-pound bags routinely around the Madison area here get down to $16 or $17 for 50 pounds. And I store that in an inexpensive galvanized trash can from one of the big box hardware stores, and I can get about pretty close to 100 pounds in the trash can, and that'll last for a long time if you ration it out without a whole lot of expense. So buy in bulk, watch for sales, store it properly so the mice and other things aren't getting at it, and you can stretch your bird feeding dollar a long way. But don't worry about heading south. The birds will find a way to take care of themselves.
Yeah, there you go, Barbara. Thank you so much for calling, and have fun on your trip, too, your annual trip. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I don't want to make us sound old right now, but over 25 years ago, that's like a quarter of a century and more, I started gardening for wildlife classes over here in Duluth. And this was before internet. And Scott Craven's work was one of the very few I could use in my classes. And I just want to thank him from the bottom of my heart for all wildlife and people who love them and want to learn. Thank you.
Oh,
well
that was nice.
Thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Scott Craven, our guest. Scott's an emeritus professor, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and comes by every couple of months to talk with us. And you know, we're taking a break from pitching on the show today, but it is our year-end member drive. And I took a quick look at our dashboard, and I see we're getting some folks who are contributing. Listener support makes everything you enjoy at WPR possible. So I hope you'll make your contribution right now. If you haven't done it already, it's a great time to support Scott and support the programs that you enjoy. Certainly the ones from 11 to 12:30, our gang really appreciates contributions during this time. So if you haven't contributed now, I hope you'll do it at WPR.org. Or you could call us. The number is 888-202-2552. Again, go to WPR.org or you can phone 888-202-2552. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Miller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, emeritus professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Always great to have Scott drop by. And certainly, again, if you'd like to join in, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Tom in Janesville next. Tom, hi.
Well, hello. I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you guys. I've got a little story that I think will make you laugh. A couple years ago, I put a live trap out for squirrels, and we have a variety of feeders out back out of the front of the patio door. I put the feeder out in the evening. In the morning, I came and looked out the patio door, and there was a cardinal caught in the live trap. And there was a Cooper's hawk sitting on top of the live trap. And the Cooper's hawk would jump down on one side of the trap and try to get the cardinal. Then he'd jump over the trap to the other side and then jump back again and over again and fly up in a tree to a little limb and then fly down and repeat the whole process again. And we took a video of it. And of course, the cardinal was going crazy inside there. And so after about 10 minutes, I walked out and the Cooper's hawk flew away. And I opened up the live trap, and I think the cardinal set probably the world speed record for getting into the bushes. He needed a little psychotherapy after that. But it was very comical to watch that Cooper's hawk trying to figure out how to get that cardinal out of that live trap.
Yes, I can imagine. The hawk was probably very frustrated, and the cardinal was terrified. But apparently all's well that ends well.
Thank you very much for calling, Tom. Appreciate it. That's a great story. Dee in the Bayfield Peninsula. We'll go to you now. Hi, Dee.
Hello. Hi. So the other day I had the joy of having what I thought was a bobcat in my yard, and it was very interested in my chicken coop. So prior to that, I had three chickens that disappeared in just a short period of time, so I'm guessing that's where they went. But the next day, I also saw them in the yard, but I actually got to be, like, at two different points, one time about 15 feet away and one time about 20 feet away, just because I was moving about my yard and happened upon him. So when I did some research, I got some books from the library and sort of decided it was a bobcat, but then I started looking at some pictures of lynx. And because my sightings weren't for long periods of time, I was wondering if there was maybe something else that could help me make my decision whether this was a bobcat or a lynx, or if even lynx are around in the Bayfield Peninsula area.
Well, if they're going to be around, the Bayfield Peninsula is a reasonable place, but lynx are a very rare animal in Wisconsin, perhaps not even present at some times, and in other times maybe an animal or two here and there. So if you got a good look at it, any field guide like the Peterson Field Guide to Mammals or, excuse me, Charlie Long's book, Mammals of Wisconsin, or any book that will show a side-by-side comparison, I don't think you'd have any trouble, if you've had a good look at this animal, making the distinction. The easiest thing to see are the hair tufts on the ears. So a lynx will have distinctive long tufts of dark hair on the tips of their ears. The bobcat won't. That's one easy thing. The other is that the lynx is just a larger, furrier animal, much longer legs and huge feet. The spotting pattern may be a little different, and there's going to be a little difference in the black tip on the tail, whether it goes all the way around or whether it doesn't. But all those characteristics would be lined up in a field guide, and you should be able to make that distinction if you've had a good look at the animal. But again, especially with a pair of binoculars, but if you're close enough, even with the naked eye, those tufts of hair on the ears will make the call for you.
Yeah, that's for sure. Dee, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Well, Chuck, in Stevens Point, let's give you a chance now. Hi, Chuck. Chuck, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Larry, Scott.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I wanted to see if, feeding the birds after evolution, like 100 years or so, would they maybe not learn how to find food on their own if this keeps up and everybody's feeding? What are your thoughts?
Among the things that we have to worry about these days, Chuck, I don't know that birds getting to the point where they can't fend for themselves is should make the list. I don't think, not something that I've heard about very much. It's an interesting thought, but I think for the most part, while some birds may become very dependent on a particular feeder, like the one I'm looking at out the window here as I'm talking with you, which is currently occupied by a big fat gray squirrel and no birds. But in any event, birds that become pretty regular visitors to a feeding station are probably the exception amongst all birds. There's a lot of landscape out there, and a lot of birds don't necessarily have access to a nicely filled feeding station. So there are always going to be some that are entirely on their own. There are probably some that are quite dependent on feeders. But remember that many of these birds migrate as well and have to fend for themselves at certain times of the year, when they're wintering perhaps in South or Central America, or getting to and from. Bottom line, Chuck, it's an interesting thought, but I don't think it's anything we need to be too concerned about. And if we make life a little easier for a few birds that happen to be around our feeding stations, well, you know, we enjoy it. They seem to benefit from it. It's probably okay in the long run.
Yeah, there you go, Chuck. Thank you so much for calling. Dave in Lac des Flambeaux, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Love to listen to you guys always. You guys were talking about the various animals coming in with unsalted peanuts, and we've got flying squirrels coming in for them. Every night at, like, you can almost set your clock by about 5:04 in the evening, we set out about 6 little unsalted peanuts. And we'll see a little flying squirrel. He comes up, grabs one, runs off the railing on the deck, runs up in a tree, chomps it down, comes back about 3 minutes later, grabs another one, hops off, and do it. It's been wonderful entertainment for us over the last few weeks.
Well, that's a great story.
It is. And flying squirrels can be very attractive visitors to feeders. Sometimes people wonder why, I thought I just filled that feeder late the afternoon before, and now it's empty and nobody's been here. But they're nocturnal, and they do visit at night. If you've got a lighted area that they acclimate to, you can see them very well. Some people put red filters on a floodlight or whatever. The red light doesn't seem to bother them, but they are a lot of fun to watch. And even more fun when the feeder's, you know, high enough up that they don't want to scramble to it, that they glide in from up in a tree. And that's kind of neat to see, too. So if you have the opportunity, go ahead and enjoy feeding the flying squirrels. They're very cute, very soft, big-eyed. They're just attractive little small mammals.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun to watch. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Boy, you had a great experience there. Thank you. John in Port Wing, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just going to comment a couple of things. One, sighting of lynx has been kind of common right up in the cornucopia area. I have a friend that took some pictures of one.
Okay, well, that's the right area. So you mean recently, John?
Yeah, and another friend said that she saw one here in the last couple of days.
Yeah, well, that's certainly possible. People are seeing and reporting cougars pretty regularly now as they move through, and a lynx is a distinctive animal. So if people see it, word gets around. But if there are a few around, then maybe this is what the previous caller had been seeing.
Yeah, I'm sure it's in the same general area. So
yeah, well, yeah. Thanks for
yeah.
On my way to town the other day, down to Iron River, along County Highway A up here, I observed a coyote on a gut pile in a hayfield.
Huh.
On a return trip, the coyote was gone, and a small flock of turkeys was working over that gut pile like you wouldn't believe, and I was kind of surprised, but then I guess it makes sense. It's a source of protein, and I wonder if they drove the coyote off.
Well, that's possible. I mean, remains of deer killed during the hunting season, gut piles, or even carcasses that aren't found, don't last very long on the landscape. I went back to the farm where I'd been hunting on opening day last weekend, and I couldn't find so much as a blood-stained leaf where I had left the gut pile. Everything was gone, and had another friend that shot a doe, whitetail, and went to get his buddy to help him track it. And he said it took him about an hour and a half to find the carcass. And in that time, there was nothing left of the hindquarters and the internal organs. And this was during broad daylight, but the coyotes had found it that quickly and consumed a significant quantity of it before they could even track it down and recover it. So nothing goes to waste in the wild, and whether it's coyotes or turkeys or possums or fox or raccoons or weasels, that kind of thing gets used up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I wonder
I'll retell a story that when we lived on Lake Monona in the wintertime, there was a little bit of open water and there were some geese on that water, and one of them climbed out of the water and was on the ice, and an eagle came down and whacked the goose and fed on the goose. And we saw the whole thing. And then a little later on, the eagle was gone. A fox came all the way across the lake and consumed some of that goose, whatever was left. And a little later, we looked back, and the fox was gone, and there were some crows eating probably whatever was left of that poor Canada goose. So it was a fun, interesting thing to watch.
Yep.
No doubt about it. Well, Mickey in Madison has something to deal with, I think. So let's go there. Mickey, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I am involved with several other people trying to trap a lost dog, and we have her on camera near our trap where we are baiting and have been for weeks. And unfortunately, possums come every night and beat her to it, and they're taking all of her bait. And I've done a lot of reading on possums. They seem really sweet, but we just don't want them to come around, and wondering if you have any advice for how to feed this dog but keep the possums away.
Where are you? Where in Wisconsin is this happening?
Madison.
Yeah, whereabouts in Madison? I mean, our neighbors have been looking for a lost dog now for about a month or so. I'm just wondering if it's the same.
Oh, yeah, no, it's. We know the owner of the dog, and unfortunately that happens quite often. And I encourage the neighbor to check with Lost Dogs of Wisconsin and Dane County Humane Society, to register with them so that they would be on the lookout and give you a call or give them a call if their dog came in as a stray.
Well, the possum situation, obviously you've got a large box type trap if you're trying to trap the dog. I would be tempted. I've just been trying to think of some options here. Possums are reasonably widely distributed, but the colder it gets, the less active they are, and that may slow them down a little bit. But I think you could get by with much smaller traps, like probably an 8x8 inch door or whatnot, and get several of those and distribute them around where the trap for the dog is set, and just try and intercept and remove some of the offending possums so that there's a better chance the dog can actually get to the bait and into the trap. That's about the only thing I can think of. I can't think of a bait that wouldn't, possums will eat darn near anything. So there's no bait situation that would solve the problem. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I have to
wait as long as you can to put it out, I suppose. But
yeah, I'd be tempted to try and thin those possums out. They're very easy to trap. And if a smaller trap would be, you could borrow some or whatever, and get three or four of those out and start relocating the possums so that the dog has a better shot at the bait. That's the only thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. Thanks, Mickey, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor from the UW Extension Wildlife Ecology. department. He's a UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. That's the proper way to say it. Here we are taking a break from our normal pitching on our year-end member drive right now. And I'm going to make a little pitch anyway. We're part of your day. We are your source for connecting to the community. Scott Craven does a wonderful job every other month coming by. Jamie Nack and David Drake come the other month, the opposite month. And if you enjoy this program and all the programs that we have on Wisconsin Public Radio, we hope you'll make a contribution. You can go to WPR.org, it's WPR.org, or you can phone 888-202-2552. 888-202-2552. It's our year-end member drive. Listener support makes everything you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. So make your contribution right now at WPR.org or by phoning 888-202-2552. Scott's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your calls and questions. And for now, we'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us on the Ideas Network. If you haven't contributed, do it now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Great to have him back. Certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. What questions are on your mind? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. And some callers online, Scott. So let's go back to the phones and to Rick in Portage County. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. I wanted to share a story from deer hunting this year. We have a ground blind on our land that's built out of forest debris, and we have a chair in the middle of it. It just looks like a big brush pile. And opening day, my wife shot a buck there. So the next morning, Sunday, this is the season just gone by, I took over that deer stand, and I hadn't been sitting there for long, and I see these two critters, little ones, scurrying around in and out of the logs and the brush, and finally one came out and sat and looked at me, and I assumed they might be mice, but they were real round with real short tails and kind of a pointy nose and beady eyes, and I thought, that's no mouse. So I started putting out little pieces of cookie, and pretty soon they were all over the place. So that evening I came in and got a field guide out, and we typed them out as least shrews. I suspected they were shrews, but I didn't know what kind. And the next day, so I took a baggie of sunflower nuts out, and that's probably why I didn't get a deer that morning. I spent most of the morning feeding shrews, and they ended up coming out, and they would, when the little piles were gone, I actually had them come out and sit on my boots and look at me as if, well, that's gone. I know you got more. And they ate a half a bag, full baggie of sunflower nuts. They were just extremely entertaining. And I was actually, since you know how slow deer hunting can get, I was actually having more fun with that than deer hunting, actually.
Yeah, Rick, that's a great story. Scott, a comment?
Well, I just want to ask, Rick, were they dark, kind of a charcoal gray with a pointed snout and a short tail?
Very round, you know, more when they sat, they were much more round than a mouse. And according to our field guide, this is pretty much at the northern part of their range. Is that correct?
Well, but just tell me, were they about the size of a mouse, though, overall?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what you were seeing is probably arguably the most common small mammal in the state. Those are short-tailed shrews. They are shrews, technically short-tailed shrews. The genus name is Blarina, and there is a least shrew too, but it wouldn't be much bigger than the end of your little finger. And these short-tailed shrews are all over the place, and they are fairly inquisitive and will eat a wide variety of things, but they're while they'll eat seeds, if you had something with a bit of protein to it, a crumble of cheese, a piece of sandwich meat, they'd have probably really been excited about that, because they are basically carnivorous. They're the animal that, if you're trapping mice in your garage, will also get into the garage and eat the mouse right out of the trap. So I'm almost certain that's what you were seeing, and they're very, very common, but not commonly seen alive, because they're reasonably secretive. But hey, that's the kind of experience that passes the time when you're deer hunting. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it really is. Rick, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Larry, go ahead, Scott. Well, I was going to say, since we broke the ice on a question tangentially related to deer hunting, hopefully before we run out of time, we can kind of go over what happened during the recent deer season.
Let's do that right now. Let's talk about the season itself.
Well, there were some pretty interesting things. If you think back to 2019, it was a year with some marginal weather, to say the least, and the corn harvest was very much delayed. There were lots of things going against the state deer hunters, and as a result, the harvest was depressed. It was just the opposite this year. This was, by the way, the 169th nine-day gun season, so there's a long history for this here in Wisconsin. But a couple of things of note. First of all, the conditions were great. The weather was nice, with the exception of some rain on Tuesday and Wednesday, and the corn harvest was much more normal. And in part, perhaps because of COVID, where we saw big boosts in visitation to state parks, national parks, more fishing, more boating, there were more hunters out there. So license sales of all deer licenses were up about 3.5% from the same time last year. There were almost 570,000 licenses sold for gun privileges. And when you factor in all of the types of licenses, gun, bow, crossbow, sports, patrons, et cetera, 820,000 licenses. So that's a lot. And again, the trend in number of female hunters going up, they being the largest growing demographic, continued. And the number of female hunters, deer hunters, reached 92,000 plus this year. So that's pretty cool. But I guess the nuts and bolts of it is, how successful were these folks? And the preliminary figures released by the DNR yesterday showed about 180, almost 189,000 deer taken during the nine-day gun hunt. And that included 85,000 bucks, so that's pretty good. But since the archery season opened way back on September 12th, the total registration of deer taken by folks with bows, with crossbows, and with the gun season is 305,000. So that's pretty good. Well above 2019, the gun deer harvest was up almost 16% statewide. It was a good season from a lot of standpoints, and suggested that the herd was in pretty good shape. More people were participating. The weather was nice. It went very well. And I should point out that there are lots of additional opportunities coming up. The muzzleloader season is on right now. That comes immediately after the gun deer season. September 10th to the 13th is a statewide four-day antlerless only hunt, where folks can fill those unfilled antlerless tags. And then for some counties, there will be a holiday season, a nine-day holiday season from December 24th to January 1st. So yet another opportunity to get out. And then finally, the archery season continues until January 3rd. And in some places in the farmland zone communities, that archery season is extended until January 31st. So lots of opportunity yet to be had. And one other thing I wanted to point out is that, as we do every year, December 10th, which is coming up next week, is a key deadline for some of the DNR permit and tag applications like spring turkeys and bear harvest permits or preference points and so forth. So folks who are looking to line up what they're going to be doing next year should pay attention to what's due December 10th. So yeah. All in all, it was a successful deer season, and it continues. I wanted to mention, we can get back to this if the listeners have any questions about it, but CWD is still around. Chronic wasting disease is still a big issue, and it struck home with me again this year when my son, who came home for the crossbow season for a weekend, shot a very nice deer very close to the house, and I processed the thing and got it in refrigeration and the freezer and whatnot, and we submitted the head for testing, and it was only 4 or 5 days later that we got the results back that it was CWD positive. So I had to dispose of that entire animal, which is for folks who kind of dismiss CWD, it really comes home to roost. When you harvest an animal, you think you have some venison for the year, you go to all the trouble to process it or at least hold it until you get the test results, and then whammo, the thing's positive. You're not supposed to consume them, although I know some people do, and out it goes. So all of a sudden from, wow, we got a deer, the freezer's full, to, whoa, we've got nothing. It's a very frustrating thing, and it happened to a couple of other buddies this year for the first time. That's the sixth time for my son and I, and they were pretty bummed out by it. So, you know, I just urge everybody, not just hunters, to be concerned that CWD is still a big issue in the state. It hasn't really gone anywhere. We're creeping up on the 2022 20-year anniversary since the discovery of CWD, and boy, I just wish we could make some progress on stemming the tide of that disease. So I realize COVID's a much bigger concern for the population as a whole right now, including me, but CWD is still out there and is still causing problems for a lot of folks. So there you have it.
Scott Craven, our guest today. Yeah, Scott, thank you. Wildlife ecologist. You can join in, and we have a lot of callers online, Scott, so I think we'll go back to the phones and to Logan in Green Bay. Logan, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, we get lots of animals coming to our property, and I feed them all, regardless of the color, creed, and size. All are welcome, even stray cats. Now I have a question. Occasionally I encounter ducks and geese, and they seem to be fond of bread. And somebody cautioned me against feeding them because it's detrimental to the health. Do you have any comment on that, sir?
Feeding ducks with bread or geese with bread, Scott?
You know, especially around urban areas where there are lots of Canada geese hanging around wherever there's a water source, and there's usually mallards and a few other ducks with them, it's a pretty common thing to see folks taking a bag of stale bread down to the local pond or the riverside or something and feeding those birds. I don't think unless it's really overdone that it's particularly detrimental, especially with geese. Their gizzard is the size of your fist and can process just about anything. And they've got water right there to make sure that the dryness of that bread and so forth might not be a problem. Generally, although it's advised against with some things, like talking earlier about putting it in your backyard feeder where it may attract undesirable birds, in the case of occasionally throwing a crust of bread to the ducks or geese, it's a... You know, I'm sure there are some biologists who would take issue with this with me, but I think the benefit of being able to interact with those animals, especially with kids, is it outweighs what they might say is, that's hollow calories or no nutrition or could be detrimental to some species. All of that is true, but I think in some moderation or done only occasionally, the benefits of getting people close enough to those animals to see them up close and personal, introduce them to the kids, watch some of their behaviors and so forth, outweighs the downside, at least for me. So I'll go out on a limb and say that our caller from Green Bay, Logan, I guess it was, is probably okay as long as they're not, you know, going to the local bakery every day and picking up a 50-pound sack of something that was going to be disposed of and dumping that out where the birds are unnecessarily concentrated. And then that can facilitate the spread of all sorts of other problems for the birds. So, again, like many things, done in moderation, I personally think you're okay.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Nick in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Scott. I'm a huge fan of yours, Scott. I believe all kids should be in the woods, so my kids go in the woods constantly. And our favorite place is bark housing here in Green Bay. And the story I got is that I think it was the beginning of last month I was home for a week because I had some health issues. And we were really bored because the kids are doing virtual learning stupid stuff. And my kids are like, let's go out to the woods. I'm like, okay. And this is like 4 or 5 o'clock at night. So it's getting pretty dark. And I got a friend that's a biologist. And he's like, there's nothing in the woods that'll hurt you at night. So we're walking in bark housing. And all of a sudden we can hear something coming through the woods. And I said, stop. We'll just stop and wait and see what happens. And here comes a doe, and she hopped on the trail, looked at us, and my kids just, they didn't know what to do. They were just so amazed. It was cool to see them so amazed, and the doe didn't care about us. She just sat there watching us, and I think all the kids should be in the woods. It's just a magical place for the kids.
Yeah, Nick, thanks for calling. Scott, a comment?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Nick. I think that there are so many benefits of kids getting outdoors, whether it's in the woods or in a prairie or in a marsh or any other natural environment, to have a chance to see what's going on and see what wildlife is out there and how they interact with each other and with people and so on is tremendously valuable. It's been especially valuable or would be under the circumstances we've been put into with virtual learning and people having to stay home and restrictions put in place by the presence of COVID that, for my family, at least, the fact that we are lucky enough to live out in the countryside, and I've got 12 acres here out looking out my windows where I've spent all kinds of time since the onset of COVID doing little projects around the yard and pruning trees and just doing things outside that have maintained my sanity, I guess. And I have some empathy for folks who perhaps live in, you know, an urban area where they have to travel to a park or something to experience those things. But beyond that, you know, this gets back to if we were going to talk a little bit about Christmas ideas, I would recommend to Nick and anybody else who shares this this particular opinion that you read a book called Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv, L-O-U-V. This is what started the whole discussion of what he called nature deficit disorder and kids not getting outside and not learning about natural events and perhaps growing up not valuing wildlife and wild places. And it's a good read. I think it'll bring home to Nick or anybody else who looks at that book or all the follow-up things that have been done about the importance of getting kids outside. So there's just a ton of neat stuff out there. It's the way most of us old timers were brought up, but it's not as common now as it once was.
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, thanks again. Kurt in Oak Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Several years ago, we were up in about 4.5-5 miles south of Rhinelander, directly south across on the Wisconsin River. And we went to a lake over there and we just turned on a dirt road and we saw a creature. It was probably 3 times as tall as a house cat. It was a darkish gray, almost blackish color, pointed ears, but no tufts of fur up on top of the ears. It was very strange looking. And it was gone in a heartbeat as soon as it stopped and saw us. I'm wondering, we looked at all kinds of pictures. I could not identify what it was.
Wow, that's a tough one. But you say it was dark in color?
It was dark in color. It was late summer.
Well, I think the kicker here is going to be the tail. Did it have a tail?
It was facing us when we saw it. I did not really see any tail.
Well, it certainly could have been a bobcat. They appear grayish in terms of overall color, although they have a variety of different patterns to their coat. It would be much taller than a cat, but it would have a cat-like appearance. But there would be no noticeable tail. Up in that country, another fairly large, very dark animal that would get out of harm's way as a fisher. But they're not particularly tall. They're basically a big weasel and built a little closer to the ground. So if it had long legs, I guess bobcat's the most likely possibility.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, too. Kurt, thank you. Catelyn Sugar Camp, your turn. Hi, Cal.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I agree with Nick. I was very lucky. The three places we lived when I was young, we're always next to meadows in the woods. I was lucky I lived in the woods. Anyway, I've seen a fabulously beautiful mouse, and I think it's called a woodland jumping mouse, and it's got like a 10 or 11-inch tail, beautiful roan brown with a dark stripe down its back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful little animals. There are two of them in the state. There's a woodland jumping mouse and a meadow jumping mouse. They're relatively difficult to tell apart. They have a tremendous long tail and great big back feet. And because of those large feet and their propensity to jump, they're often called kangaroo mice. But the technical term is woodland or meadow jumping mouse. And both are beautifully marked with a dark back, a medium brown or rusty brown side, and then a lighter colored belly. So they're neat little things to see. Very few people ever get a chance to see one up close.
Yeah, that is very cool. Cal, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a break from our normal pitching on the show today, we're still in our year-end member drive, though. You know, we're part of your day. We're your source for connecting to your community and to the state. And certainly during this show, we appreciate your gift, during all the shows, as a matter of fact. If you'd like to contribute, I hope you will. Go to WPR.org, or phone 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552. Make your contribution. It's kind of a vote for this program. The shows that we do day in and day out, Scott Craven, our guest every other month on the show, always does a wonderful job. And we always get lots of calls. Well, it's our year-end member drive. Your support makes everything you enjoy on WPR possible. So I hope you'll make your contribution right now. Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552. If you've already contributed, thank you. If you haven't, do it right now. Go to WPR.org. And thanks again to Scott Craven, our wildlife ecologist, for being with us today. Always a pleasure to have him along. And thank you so much for listening. And I hope you'll stay with us. There's lots more in store right through the afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.